Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Roman Paszka, and today I will be talking to Takeshi Morisato, who is the author of Faith and Reason in Continental and Japanese Philosophy, Reading Tanabe Hajime and William Desmond, a book that was published in 2019 by Bloomsbury. Hello, Takeshi.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to hear you. I'm just going to start with a question about you, about yourself, if you could introduce yourself a little bit, about your career, your research, and how did you become involved in this field?
Okay, so I'm currently a research associate at the Sun Yat-sen University in China. But before that, I was doing postdoc in Europe and PhD also in Europe, specifically Belgium. And then before that, I was studying philosophy in United States and teaching a little bit there as well. And even before that, I was in Japan. So I'm kind of all over the place. I study and research in philosophy, both in North America, Europe, and Japan, and now I'm in China. How I involved with this field, if I go back in 2002, I wanted to study political science in the beginning, but the what really interested me about political science was the political theories. So what are the assumptions and presuppositions that we make before we come up with the policies? And that sort of led me to study philosophy. So in the grand scale of this field as philosophy, that's how I started my career in philosophy a long time ago. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just listening to you.
And then how I started my field in comparative Japanese philosophy, I was originally interested in this sort of German idealism, specifically Hegel. Then I started to work on the field of existentialism. But in that process, basically, I struggled to find a topic that I could work for my doctoral dissertation. Basically, I felt so much have been written on Kant and Hegel, and if you specialize in existentialism, you might not actually complete the academic program because you're going to have existential crisis and all these things. So I thought maybe, I should work on some sort of neo-Hegelian philosophy. So for instance, Slavia from Russian philosophy. And I talked to my supervisor at the time, and he is William Desmond in the title of the book. And I talked to him and said, maybe I should work on British idealism or neo-Hegelian Russian philosophy. Then he said, no, maybe you should go pick up some Kyoto school. And I read this book, Philosophy as Metanoetics. I discovered this book called The Philosophy as Metanoetics in used bookstore in New York City. And I read the book during my flight back to Europe, and I really enjoyed it. I would like you to actually explore more in this field. So I started my academic work in the field of comparative and Japanese philosophy in 2012. So that's the ways in which I got involved with this field.
Mm-hmm. So that was actually the second question that I had prepared. How did you get the idea for the book? How was the book born? But you already explained that. So let me move on to my next question.
Maybe I can give you a little bit more specific picture. So basically, I wanted to write on Kierkegaard. So existentialism in the works of Søren Kierkegaard. But I couldn't imagine writing academic dissertation on him just because the content of his writing is so, contradictory to the ways in which we would behave and function in academia. So he has so many things to make fun of academics in his writings. So that was just sort of a struggle that I had. How can I work on Kierkegaardian framework of thinking within the context of academia? And that really led to a sort of like this comparative work. So the post-Hegelian philosophy in continental European context, and also Kyoto School philosophy that dealt with that kind of question from their own cultural background, which is closer to mine. So that's sort of the ways in which I came up with this topic, I think.
Mm-hmm. And the reason you chose Tanabe to work on Tanabe's philosophy, just that book that you happened to find and read on the flight back to Europe, or
right? That's my supervisor actually found that book. So he told me the story that he bought two copies of Philosophy as a Metanoetics, and he claims that he gave one copy to Richard Carney, another famous philosopher from North America, and he also read it. And he really liked this concept of metanoesis, that is this transformation of the person that grounds the metaphysics. So he really liked that idea, but he really wanted to know how Kyoto School thinkers critiqued Hegel and reappropriated to have their own framework of dialectical thinking. So that was the sort of contingent, you know, first proposal that my supervisor made. So that was purely coincidental that he read it. And but then after that, I just sort of trace back the, you know, first when supervisor tells you to read something, you're not always, you know, you're always skeptical, right? That when supervisor says, this is great, you should read it. And you read it and it's like, I'm not sure if I want to spend next 4 years of my life on just this guy. But there was a strange click that I had. I think once I read it, I felt like, oh, okay, I can see something. I can do something with this. And also there are so much mystery to what's not available. So there's, you know, Philosophy as a Metanoetics is like half volume of 15 volumes of Tanabe Hajime, complete works of Tanabe Hajime, which we call the Tanabe Hajime Zenshu. So I felt like, wow, there's something more to explore in relation to these, you know, complete works. And I think that sort of grabbed me into comparative Japanese philosophy.
Okay. Because you, so the book actually grew out of your doctoral dissertation, right?
Yes.
Okay. If you could tell us a little bit more about the structure of the book, the parts, the chapters, a little bit about the contents of each section or chapter.
So the most prominent part of the book that sort of shows some, how should I say, remnants of the doctoral dissertation structure is the first part, which talks about methodology of comparative philosophy. I think nowadays it's not a problem to talk about comparative philosophy in Japanese philosophy, let's say in North American philosophical context, but it's still very difficult to do in European philosophical context. For instance, my department had 35, 40 full-time professors of philosophy and 120 PhD students on the roster. And I was the only one person working on anything non-Western, non-European at the time, when I was a doctoral student. So basically, you were proposing something that the most professors are not qualified to judge whether or not this is actually philosophical or not. You know, you can't expect a professor of philosophy in a European university to be able to read Japanese text either, right? So it's not part of the philosophical language. So a kind of methodological reflection that I have to give in the beginning of the book is shows the fact that I'm addressing to the certain audience, specifically four people in my jury, as well as all my peers at the university. So 120 PhD students around me, as well as 40 professors there, that are, hey, there is a field called comparative philosophy, And here's the reason why we could do this. So you can see that's the kind of the, you know, leftover from doctoral dissertation. But I kept it because I think it's still relevant. I don't know how many comparative philosophy specialists in my the department that I graduated from. And, you know, I'm a part of this group that actually promotes Japanese philosophy in a European academic context, which is called European Network of Japanese Philosophy. And Roman, you happen to be the vice president of the organization. But this, you know, organization is quite new, and I think we're still struggling to find a space in which we can talk about Japanese philosophy in a European academic context. Therefore, I have to give this sort of methodological discussions of how can we do this in European academic context. Mm. I'll stop there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... As you mentioned, yes, we for everybody listening to us, Takeshi and I go back a long time. I think 6 or 7 years. We've known each other. We've worked together on a couple of projects, and actually, in this European Network of Japanese Philosophy, one of the discussions that we have constantly is about the status of non-Western traditions of thought, like Japanese philosophy or Chinese philosophy, within the so-called Western canon, right? To go back to your book, actually, this is a discussion that you also mention in the introduction, right? You mentioned at some point that there's this tendency to group in Western philosophy or in the Western academic system, there's a tendency to just lump in together non-Western thinkers according to geographical and linguistic categories, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So, do you think that's mm-hmm. problematic? And why do you think it's problematic?
I think my basic stance is always like the words don't. The meaning of the words always depend on the context. So it's a kind of Wittgensteinian stance. So you could use a word to be harmful to somebody, but you could say in such way that it's not harmful. So it's not something that I could just say it's literally wrong to say non-Western. But the problem with this term is that it's overtly clear that the adjective has a negative, you know, negation of something, right? So non-Western is not Western thinking. So what is implying in this adjective is that, what counts as the history of philosophy is the Western, and let's just try to talk about something that we cannot categorize within that framework. Mm-hmm. So a kind of heuristic device to name something. And of course, it's... you know, it's debatable whether it is better than, you know, Eastern or Western, you know, Oriental, Occidental distinctions that we often talk about in the context of cultural studies. But non-Western philosophy, is quite negative. I mean, if you think about Heidegger's famous statement that the Western philosophy is oxymoron, right? That philosophy only exists in the West. And he didn't mean it to say that the philosophy is the best thing that could have happened, right? For him, the notion of philosophy is contracted in relation to the concept of thinking, but the distinction still survives. And I think it's quite misused in contemporary academic context. So when we say non-Western, it's like, oh, you mean like, you know, 75% of the entire earth, right? That Asian philosophy is 60% of the, earth population. And when you say Asian, all the Asians go like, okay, which Asia are you talking about? Are you talking about Chinese philosophy? Or which part of China are you talking about? Are you talking about a Korean philosophy, Japanese philosophy? Or are we including Southeast Asian, history, intellectual history of Southeast Asia and all these positive adjective, right? The China, Japan, Korea that has complexity of its own historical narrative is completely ignored. So I think when you say non-Western philosophy, that means you have no idea what you're talking about, right? And but you're trying to be polite by saying, okay, it's not Western. So I like to say, like, look, if it's based on this assumption that the what you're familiar with as a philosophy is the history of European philosophy or the Western history of philosophy, whatever that might mean. I acknowledge that what you're referring to as the other traditions as non-Western, but the adjective doesn't carry any meaning except the fact that you don't really know about the content of that, what the word is modifying. So that's, I guess, the problem that I would have. Awfully unclear. I'm working at the Chinese university. So if you go to the university library in China, it's interesting, right? Depending on where you live, what counts as domestic and foreign is always relative to the land in which you live. So if you go to the Sun Yat-sen University Library, you have Chinese books and English books, and you have other countries, other foreign languages. And if you go to that section, you have French, German, Arabic, Russian, and Japanese right next to each other, you know, which is quite different from our conception of what counts as a part of the canon, what doesn't count as the part of the canon. So eventually, I think we just have to stop using it, like the term non-Western.
I felt that picking up on what you said. So I felt reading your book that you discuss a lot of philosophers. You discuss Kant, you discuss Hegel, you also, of course, discuss William Desmond. So you talk about philosophers from this Western canon, but you put them in a comparative perspective by bringing Tanabe Hajime's philosophy in the whole equation, right? And I felt, when I was reading the book, I felt that this is a very valid position for comparative philosophy. And it's also one of the strengths of comparative philosophy. And if I remember correctly, you do mention in the first part where you talk about your own definition or understanding of comparative philosophy, you do talk about the strengths and weaknesses of such a démarche, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the strengths and a weakness, yeah. I mean, the weakness is precisely the fact that it's not part of the main canon of a philosophical program in actually many parts of the world. So the philosophy programs around the world tend to be very Eurocentric in general. So even if you take philosophy courses in China, well, maybe not so much in China because you have a history of Chinese philosophy in most of the programs. But if you go to Japanese universities, I think you have more professors teaching European philosophy than Japanese philosophy. And in fact, many professors would hesitate to use the term Japanese philosophy. So the weakness is just the fact that we don't have many resources to be able to substantiate our claim that the intellectual history of Japan has rich resources that provide materials for our philosophical thinking. I think that was one of the things that I mentioned. The strength is that sometimes, you know, when you step out of your own boundary, when you have certain assumptions by which you make philosophical points, it requires just a kind of transcending or crossing that boundary to be able to reevaluate what's the assumptions by which we're making these claims. You know, the example is like the notion of secularization or the sacred, right? In a contemporary society, it's quite clear in Belgium, where I am right now, that secularization is one of the dominant voice, and religion is, you know, Judeo-Christian tradition. But if you go to Japan, Judeo-Christian tradition is not the dominant form of the notion of the sacred or religiosity. right? So you have a different sense of secularization, for instance. So it raises this kind of question of, okay, what are the assumptions in which we're making these claims when we say something like religious or sacred or good or evil, truth, falsity, so on and so forth. So I think sometimes comparative philosophy actually can spark this, you know, foundational thinking that sort of, okay, you become expert in Kantian framework of thinking, or you become expert in Hegelian concepts, but then what are the assumptions that we're actually making when we hold on to these frameworks, and sometimes maybe I don't think it's impossible to do the same within the boundary of a European philosophical tradition. For instance, you can read Heidegger to get to the same point, but if you have access to different intellectual traditions, sometimes we could do things that are a lot easier to do than, for instance, reading Being and Time. That's the strength that I can think about right now.
Okay. Now, this is something that you talk about in the first part of the book. You reflect on the meaning, the definition, the understanding of comparative philosophy. And I wanted to go through the other parts. So the book consists of four parts. The first one contains these reflections on comparative philosophy. The second one discusses the fundamental problems of the philosophy of religion, thinking through rational universalism. And there you discuss Kant and Hegel, right? The third part, you talk about metaxology and the problems of the philosophy of religion. Fourth part, which has two chapters, you talk about metanoetics and the problems of the philosophy of religion. And this is where you discuss Tanabe Hajime, right? Tanabe Hajime and Buddhism and his discussion of the problems of philosophy of religion. And I do have loads of questions for you, but let me focus on some questions that pertain to the last part, the last two chapters where you discuss Tanabe Hajime. So my first question would be about Tanabe's stances on Christianity and Buddhism. So if I may quote from the book, this is page 141, by the way, you say, you write, "I would like to discuss the general problem of engaging in a comparative philosophy of religion in relation to Christianity and Buddhism." And then you go on to say, you talk about Tanabe's stances toward different sects of Buddhism as well as Christianity slightly vary from one text to another, and these variations in his reflections on different religious traditions tacitly deal with the general problem of the inter-philosophical and inter-religious dialogues between Buddhism and Christianity. So my question was about these stances, Tanabe's stances. How do they vary? If you could give us an example, maybe about his.
Okay, that's very difficult question, and I think that one of the easiest examples that you can find would be his stance toward Zen Buddhism. So within the context of Japanese Buddhism, he's very critical of Zen because Zen philosophy is a predominant voice in Kyoto school philosophy of religion and metaphysics. So for instance, if you read Nishida Kitaro, who is the founder, co-founding member of the Kyoto school philosophy, he has a strong Zen element in his philosophy. At least that's how Tanabe seems to be thinking. And so philosophy as metanoetics, for instance, is very critical of Nishida and Zen, but he slightly puts a different accent. So basically he's saying that the Zen philosophy is for somebody who practiced Zen and somebody who can actually get to the Zen insight after years of practice and years of meditation and years of living their lives in accordance with the teachings. And also, so basically his point is to say that, I recognize the possibility of that perspective, but I don't think I'm capable of reaching that point. I'm not a saint. I'm not a sage that can actually overcome these problems with my own power. So he relies on Pure Buddhist tradition as the foundation for doing philosophy. And that's when, so in the context of philosophy as metanoetics, he's clearly saying that I'm, going toward the Pure Land Buddhism rather than Zen Buddhism. Now, if you know the history of Japanese Buddhism, the distinction between Zen and Pure Land oftentimes made, we make exaggerated differences, or sometimes there's profound sameness because it's Buddhism. And I think in the context of philosophy or metanoetics, he's almost like a polemic to Zen and Nishida there. But then later texts, for instance, Existence, Love, and Practice, which is the book right after Philosophy as Metanoetics, he starts to say, there is something in Zen that I can't really give up. And then the book after that is called The Dialectic of Christianity, published in 1948. He clearly states that some Zen Buddhists are holding on to the same absolute dialectic as I'm proposing. So in the context of later philosophy of religion, he shifts within the later, within the later philosophy of Tanabe's thinking. There's sort of a, change from one perspective to another. Interestingly, he doesn't talk about Christianity almost at all in philosophy as metanoetics, but then, as you can see from the title of the book, The Dialectic of Christianity, he brings Christianity to the table, and he's basically arguing that the Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, including both Zen and Pure Land Buddhism, and Christianity and Marxism, can hold this dialectical relationship with each other to constitute ideal human society and live in accordance with the sense of the sacred or the religious. He doesn't talk about that at all in the beginning, except he uses this term metanoesis, which comes from the Bible, right? Metanoia, the confess, right? Repent. That's the line from the gospel. But he uses the concept but doesn't talk much about it. And then later he puts more emphasis on Christianity in later books. So I think that's the kind of deviations. Sometimes he relies on the existential aspect. So he would say something like, okay, theoretically, that might be possible. But as a single individual, I can't possibly see myself going through it, in reference to Zen and Christianity. So he's already ambiguous. Like, okay, is he saying that this is theoretically impossible to hold on to this kind of dream of being absolutely good in Christian or Zen Buddhist context, or he's saying that no, I as single individual, and I as a Tanabe Hajime, I can't make this happen. So I have to provide different ways in which we can do a metaphysics and philosophy of religion. Depends on how you interpret it. I think if you put the emphasis on certain text, you can make a point that, yeah, Tanabe is seriously thinking about pushing Pure Land over against all the other religious traditions. But then sometimes he looks like, he looks like saying there's some truth to the all different traditions. So he qualifies quite a bit. It's very difficult to pin down. This is precisely the position he's taking. So you have to kind of look at how he takes different positions as he goes through his work, I would say.
Are these the layers that you talk about in the last chapter about Tanabe? So you do mention that there are two layers in his later works, there are two layers to his works on the philosophy mm-hmm. of religion.
Right. So these layers are even, I would say, architectonic of these ambiguities. So these ambiguities just happening within the text from one place to another, but overall structure of metanoesis or absolute dialectic that he calls has these two layers, that there's a sort of intermediation of, you know, the notion of the divine absolute and human relative has to be intermediate with each other. So that layer of two layers of dialectical framework is something overarching, more comprehensive than these ambiguities in between. So, yeah, I think, you know, this is really the problem, because some people ask me, so is Tanabe a Christian thinker, or is he a Buddhist thinker, or what is he? It's very difficult to answer. I think in some ways, yeah, he's very close to the Christianity, and some people associate that. This is one of the things that are, you know, some people said, like, yeah, but you put in Tanabe almost right next to Catholic Christianity, you know, Catholicism. Isn't it problematic? You know, and then you have Catholic thinkers reading my text and saying that, yeah, I don't quite understand how could Buddhism be right next to Christianity, you know? I think my take is that he refrains from holding on to one perspective or another, but rather trying to take some underlining, you know, the specific term that they use, logic. Not logic in the sense of formal logic or the structure of our thinking, but there's kind of reasonable structure that is underneath all the religious traditions. And I think that's what he's trying to get at. So in many cases, we would see the discrepancy between his understanding of, you know, Shinran, for instance, from the people who actually live in a Pure Land Buddhist tradition and study Shinran. I think there's a kind of discrepancy between the two. But these ambiguities are within those two layers that I talked about in my book.
Mm-hmm. I see. I'm sorry for asking all these difficult questions. But
yeah, it's really exciting, and you know, it actually rejuvenating me to rethink these problems that I worked on. So please keep asking.
I find this absolutely fascinating. There's another thing that I actually found really fascinating about the conclusion. It's not the bulk of the conclusion. It's just a note that you wrote down in the first part of the conclusion. So you discuss all these philosophers, Kant and Hegel, Desmond and Tanabe, and then at the end you write that, if I may quote again, I found this very genuine and sincere, and I absolutely loved this attitude. You say, it still seems that I lack my own thought on the questions. It may be so. I do have to confess that I do not yet have any systematic framework of thinking that I can call my own, nor do I know how to articulate my original responses to the questions of religion in my own terms. I found this very powerful, like I said, because it's very honest and genuine. And I found this very powerful. I wanted to ask, so the book was published in 2019, right? I wanted to ask you if things have changed in the meantime.
Did I come up with my world changing the Copernican revolution of new systemic way of thinking? I think, you know, like when you start philosophy, you know, doctoral program, or when you start actually philosophy, right? That when you start writing philosophy, undergraduate, graduate program oftentimes just ask you to write what you understood from reading the text. And then maybe graduate school, you started to talk about what's the original contribution that you can provide to this reading of this text or to the solution to the problem. I think at the doctoral dissertation level, I was driven to come up with my own solution to the problem. So it's the problem is always the first issue, rather than having the absolute knowledge of Tanabe and William Desmond. So my take was to say, like, okay, what can we learn from these thinkers about the problem of philosophy of religion and how we can solve that problem? You know, this is really the struggle at the end, because in generally in European academic context, especially continental philosophy, it's actually pretentious to say that I'm going to solve the problem and I'm going to provide my own framework of thinking to solve a problem. I can't even imagine saying that to many of my teachers back then. But I think what I could have, you know, what I have learned from writing that book, perhaps, is that, look, but generally trying to understand how the thinker thought and just to get the best of that frame, like, so the best benefit of the doubt that you can provide to the framework of thinking and try to deal with the question will lead to some kind of original standpoint. So you can actually grant your own answer to the question. So even though maybe at the end of the book, I'm answering to the question almost with Tanabean or, you know, a metaxological voice at the end, there's something original to my way of answering that question. And I'm not yet entirely sure if there's any name. So, for instance, right, William Desmond worked in German idealism, and he recognizes the problems with the ways in which Hegel, for instance, talk about dialectic. So the his criticism of dialectic is that it's closed self-determination, that it lacks the understanding of the foundation in which it's possible, and that foundation requires to open the space between self and other, and he calls that between. By the way, in Kyoto School philosophy, you have Watsuji, who talks about some similar notion of the betweenness. And I don't think this is just a linguistic coincidence. And then Tanabe talks about this conversion of the perspective that allows the open model of dialectic, which he calls absolute dialectic. And that middle, he says, is nothingness, right? There's no division between self and other in a way that you put two, you know, determinate entities, but there's open space between the two. And because of that, we can actually intermediate these terms. So, and then he uses the word metanoesis there, right? That I don't have any name that, you know, I don't even know how to say it, like Maurice Satorian, you know, I don't even know how to make the adjective out of my last name. But I think, you know, there's freedom and creativity involved with this kind of notion of openness. Or sometimes Desmond talks about this sort of agapeic release or transcendence. In Tanabe's language, it's much more like, you know, metanoetic self-transcendence that goes beyond the, you know, given framework of thinking. Has a freedom enough to be able to do your own thing. So, for instance, if Roman, if you read, you know, Metaxology and philosophies of metanoetics, I think your interpretation of it in accordance with their own philosophical framework of thinking will result in something different from mine, just because they're emphasizing in this irreducibility of the singular, right? That each single individual is irreducible to each other such that there's openness between self and other. So I'm still convinced with the conclusion that I made. I can't, you know, pin down yet, this is the absolute framework that I can come up with. But perhaps, you know, after that, I study 2 years at the Research Center for East Asian Studies at the University Libre de Bruxelles in Belgium. And at that time, I specialized in Kukai from pre-modern Japanese philosophy. That sort of allowed me to, let's say, expand this notion of metanoesis, not something that is just relevant in contemporary continental and Japanese philosophy, but also you can look back and say, look, there are some texts from the past in history, intellectual history of Japan, that can contribute to this discussion. So I think, you know, change is not something that I would, you know, describe with the adjective or, you know, determinate concept, but I think kind of fundamental attitude that allows you to explore the different areas of world philosophies. And I think that is still with me, and I'm still convinced that's the solution that it can provide. So, you know, that's, I'm not sure if I'm, you know, giving you the right, the clear answer that everybody can understand, but it's a kind of attitude. It's a kind of existential attitude that I adopted from that project, I think. And that is still very strong with my work in academia. So maybe, you know, not in directly into my essays, but the ways I work, the ways in which I work with other scholars to compile books or edit journal volumes, or even maybe just live my daily lives. Because I think both, you know, metaxology and metanoesis talk about this self-transcendence that is not coming back to itself, right? So it's not self-determining, self-transcendence that, you know, I'm going to go beyond myself so that, I can better myself. So always come back to yourself. That's the problem with the Hegelian dialectic that both thinkers had. And they both proposes this notion of self-transcendence that actually go beyond yourself. And they talk about the importance of charity and agape self-transcendence. You know, then I wrote this one piece about Tanabe's wife. You know, if you actually pay attention to the biography of a thinker, and if we take Tanabe's concept seriously, someone who seemed to be actually living up to the ideal is his wife than himself, you know? So in some ways, I think he has a basis for living a life according to these concepts. And that part, I think, is still with me, I would say.
Okay. I think it's very clear. I have the feeling you're talking about philosophy as a way of life, in a sense.
Right. So it's a kind of original existentialism that I wanted to work on within the in academic context. And I think precisely these aspects of metaxology and philosophy as a metanoetics sort of fulfilled my desire whilst being functioning in academia, right? So it didn't just become poetry or some sort of life outside of academic philosophy. I wanted to do how we can actually convey this sort of existentialism within the continental European contemporary philosophical framework. And I think that was the conclusion that I could take from this project.
Okay. Because earlier on, you mentioned the fact that while you were in Brussels, you started working on a different thinker. You started working on Kukai. And since we're approaching the end of the interview, I wanted to ask you about your plans for the future. So, what are you working on right now? Is it still Kukai? Is it still Tanabe? What do you have on the table right now?
So, you know, this concept of betweenness, it just seems like I'm just living in between all these deadlines in academia. I'm working on many different projects at the time right now. But the one ongoing project that I would like to mention is the European Journal of Japanese Philosophy. This is the first multilingual journal dedicated to the history of Japanese philosophy. And we are compiling the fifth volume right now that should come out by the end of this year, hopefully. Keep your fingers crossed. That's the one project I'm working on. And another journal that I'm involved with groups of scholars from East Asia, is called the Journal of East Asian Philosophy from Springer. That is also on the table. These journals are basically designed to accommodate articles in comparative in Japanese and East Asian philosophy, and also providing more translations. And as I mentioned earlier, that the weakness of comparative philosophy is that we don't have enough translations to be able to substantiate our claims. So people would have to just depend upon our ability to read original language, which is not the part of a philosophical canon. So that's something that I'm working on. And by extension, I'm working on many edited volume projects. The one is with you, actually, Roman. We just launched this Asian philosophical text series from Mimesis International in Milan, Italy. We just published the first volume this March, I think. And this is the same idea that we would like to invite scholars to provide original essays, but also provide the space in which we can share our translations of Asian philosophical texts. So that's one book series that I'm actually working on. Another one is called The Studies in Japanese Philosophy from Chisokudo Publications. We are making Japanese philosophy books accessible. So we're trying to publish books that are not going to burn down your wallet after you buy. That's the whole idea of this Chisokudo Publications. And we are pushing out many books, reprinting some of the out-of-print books from the past. And we published 25 volumes from there over the last 3 years. So that's another project. Now, there's a lot of projects that I'm working as editor. There's one book as an author I'm working on is the Bloomsbury Introduction to World Philosophy series is pushing out many monographs that make non-Western or world philosophers accessible to the general audience in undergraduate level. So, you know, I'm writing a volume on Tanabe, and I have a feeling that they might actually ask me to write on Kukai. But for now, I'm finishing the manuscript. The submission deadline is end of this month. So I'm just finishing the monograph and should come out with many other books next year. So that's another monograph that I'm working on. And then many edited volumes on Kyoto School, Tanabe specifically, or Kyoto School and German philosophy. That's the in the pipeline right now. So I'm basically sort of, you know, trying to keep up with the series of deadlines that come to my Google Calendar. So when the Google Calendar says, hey, you need to submit this for next month, you know, I just go like, oh my gosh, I have to do this. But that's, you know, it's great to be working in the comparative Japanese philosophy just because there are so much unexplored materials and really exciting work with these great scholars.
It looks like you have a lot on your plate. I just wanted to add something because you mentioned the Asian philosophical texts, the book series. Actually, the second, I don't know if you know this, the second volume just came out. I just got it in the mail the other day. So,
right. That's correct. That is, yeah, the second volume is on Nishida and Philosophy of Life by actually a Japanese philosopher. His name is Higa Tatsuya from Osaka University. And yeah, that's just, it's incredible how vibrant. It's almost feels like many people worked on these issues long years, but they didn't have any venue. So these rich sort of seas are, you know, underground, and they have these foliages and, you know, shades, so they couldn't actually come out. But suddenly we have these clearing and space in which we can publish. And I think we'll be able to push out many books on Japanese philosophy in the near future.
I hope so too. And what can I say? Good luck with all the projects. I hope you meet all the deadlines.
Thank you so much. And I think I'm writing your submission at some point as well, probably.
I think so too.
Yes. As my editor, I have to actually mention that, right?
Yeah. And thank you so much for talking to us today. It's always great talking to you. Like I said, good luck with all the projects. And I hope we can do another interview next year when the Tanabe monograph is out.
Yes, hopefully. Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this great opportunity.
Okay. Thank you so much, Takeshi. And thank you, everybody. This was our discussion with Takeshi Morisato, who is the author of Faith and Reason in Continental and Japanese Philosophy. See you soon.